Tales from the Jazz Age by F. Scott Fitzgerald. Mr. Icky, the quintessence of quaintness in one act. The scene is the exterior of a cottage in West Isaacshire on a desperately Arcadian afternoon in August. Mr. Icky, quaintly dressed in the costume of an Elizabethan peasant, is pottering and doddering among the pots and dods. He is an old man, well past the prime of life, no longer young. From the fact that there is a burr in his speech, and that he has absent-mindedly put on his coat wrong side out, we surmise that he is either above or below the ordinary superficialities of life. Near him on the grass lies Peter, a little boy. Peter, of course, has his chin on his palm like the pictures of the young Sir Walter Raleigh. He has a complete set of features, including serious, somber, even funereal gray eyes, and radiates that alluring air of never having eaten food. This air can best be radiated during the afterglow of a beef dinner. He is looking at Mr. Icky, fascinated. There is silence, then the song of birds. Peter speaks. Often at night I sit at my window and regard the stars. Sometimes I think they're my stars. I think I shall be a star some day. Yes, yes, yes. I know them all. Venus, Mars, Neptune, Gloria Swanson. Oh, I don't take no stock in astronomy. I've been thinking of Lunnon, laddie, and calling to mind my daughter, who has gone for to be a typewriter. I liked Ulsa, Mr. Icky. She was so plump, so round, so buxom. Not worth the paper she was padded with, laddie. He stumbles over a pile of pots and pans. How is your asthma, Mr. Icky? Oh, worse, thank God. I'm 100 years old. I'm getting brittle. I suppose life has been pretty tame since you gave up petty arson. Oh, yes, yes. Oh, you see, Peter, laddie, when I was 50, I reformed once, in prison. You went wrong again? Oh, worse than that. The week before my term expired, they insisted on transferring to me the glands of a healthy young prisoner they were executing. And it renovated you? Renovated me. Oh, it put the old Nick back into me. This young criminal was evidently a suburban burglar and a kleptomaniac. Oh, what was a little playful arson in comparison? How ghastly. Science is the bunk. Well, I got him pretty well subdued now. Doesn't everyone who has to tire out two sets of glands in his lifetime. I wouldn't take another set for all the animal spirits in an orphan asylum. I shouldn't think you'd object to a nice, quiet old clergyman set. Clergymen haven't got glands, they have souls. There is a low, sonorous honking off stage to indicate that a large motor car has stopped in the immediate vicinity. Then, a young man, handsomely attired in a dress suit and a patent leather silk hat, comes onto the stage. He is very mundane. His contrast to the spirituality of the other two is observable as far back as the first row of the balcony. This is Rodney Devine. Devine speaks. I am looking for Ulsa Icky. Mr. Icky rises and stands tremulously between two dods. My daughter is in London. She has left London. She's coming here. I have followed her. He reaches into the little mother-of-pearl satchel that hangs at his side for cigarettes. He selects one, and, scratching a match, touches it to the cigarette. The cigarette instantly lights. I shall wait. He waits. Several hours pass. There is no sound except an occasional cackle or hiss from the dods as they quarrel among themselves. Several songs can be introduced here, or some card tricks by Devine or a tumbling act as desired. Devine speaks. It's very quiet here. Yes, very quiet. Suddenly, a loudly dressed girl appears. She's very worldly. It is Ulsa Icky. On her is one of those shapeless faces peculiar to early Italian painting. She speaks in a coarse, worldly voice. Father, here I am. Ulsa did what? Her father responds tremulously. Ulsa. Little Ulsa. They embrace each other's torsos. Oh, you've come back to help with the ploughing. No, Father. Ploughing's such a bither. I'd rather not. Though her accent is broad, the content of her speech is sweet and clean. Mr. Devine speaks. "See here, all, sir. Let's come to an understanding." He advances towards her with the graceful, even stride that made him captain of the striding team at Cambridge.
"You still say it would be, Jack? What does she mean?"
"Oh, my dear, of course it would be Jack. It couldn't be Frank."
"Frank who?"
"It would be Frank." Some risque joke can be introduced here. Mr. Icky speaks whimsically.
"Oh, no good fighting. No good fighting."
Devine, reaching out to stroke her arm with a powerful movement that made him stroke of the crew at Oxford.
"You'd better marry me."
She replies scornfully.
"Why, they wouldn't let me in through the servants' entrance of your house."
"They wouldn't. Never fear. You shall come in through the mistress's entrance."
"Sir?"
"I beg your pardon. You know what I mean."
"You want to marry my little Ulsa?"
"I do."
"Your record is clean."
"Excellent. I have the best constitution in the world."
"And the worst bylaws."
"At Eton I was a member at Pop. At Rugby I belonged to Nearbeer. As a younger son I was destined for the police force."
"Skip that. Have you money?"
"Wads of it. I should expect also to go downtown in sections every morning, in two Rolls Royces. I have also a kiddie car and a converted tank. I have seats at the opera."
"I can't sleep except in a box, and I've heard that you were cashiered from your club."
"A cashier?" "I was cashiered."
"What for?"
"I hid the polo balls one day for a joke."
"Is your mind in good shape?"
"Fair. After all, what is brilliance? Merely the tact to sow when no one is looking and reap when everyone is."
"Be careful. I will not marry my daughter to an epigram."
"I assure you of a mere platitude. I often descend to the level of an innate idea."
"None of what you're saying matters. I can't marry a man who thinks it would be Jack. Why, Frank would—"
"Nonsense."
"You're a fool."
"Ah, tat, tat. One should not judge. Charity, my girl.
What was it Nero said? With malice toward none, with charity toward all."
"That wasn't Nero. That was John Drinkwater."
"Come, who is this, Frank? Who is this Jack?"
"Gotch."
"Dempsey."
We were arguing that if they were deadly enemies and locked in a room together, which one would come out alive. Now, I claimed that Jack Dempsey would take one.
"Rot. He wouldn't have a—"
"You win."
"Then I love you again."
"So I'm going to lose my little daughter."
"Oh, you still got a house full of children."
Charles, Ulsa's brother, coming out of the cottage. He is dressed as if to go to sea. A coil of rope is slung around his shoulder, and an anchor is hanging from his neck. Charles speaks, not seeing them.
"I'm going to sea, I'm going to sea."
His voice is triumphant.
"You went to seed long ago."
"I've been reading Conrad."
"Conrad? Ah, 2 years Before the Mast, by Henry James."
"What?"
"Walter Pater's version of Robinson Crusoe."
Charles speaks to his father.
"I can't stay here and rot with you. I want to live my life. I want to hunt eels."
"I will be here when you come back."
"Why, the worms are licking their chops already when they hear your name."
It will be noticed that some of the characters have not spoken for some time. It will improve the technique if they can be rendering a spirited saxophone number. Mr. Icky speaks mournfully.
"These vales, these hills, these McCormick harvesters, they mean nothing to my children. I understand."
Charles speaks to his father more gently.
"Then you'll think of me kindly, father. To understand is to forgive." "No, no. We never forgive those we can understand. We can only forgive those who wound us for no reason at all."
"I'm so beastly sick of your human nature line. And anyway, I hate the hours around here."
Several dozen more of Mr. Icky's children trip out of the house, trip over the grass, and trip over the pots and dods. They are muttering,
"We are going away, and we are leaving you."
Mr. Icky's heart is breaking, and he speaks.
"They're all deserting me. I've been too kind. Spare the rod and spoil the fun. Oh, for the glands of a Bismarck."
There is a honking outside, probably Devine's chauffeur growing impatient for his master. Mr. Icky speaks. in misery. They do not love the soil. They have been faithless to the great potato tradition. He picks up a handful of soil passionately and rubs it on his bald head. Hair sprouts. Oh, Wordsworth, Wordsworth, how true you spoke. No motion has she now, no force. She does not hear or feel, rolled round on earth's diurnal course in someone's Oldsmobile. They all groan, and shouting life and jazz, move slowly toward the wings. Charles speaks. Back to the soil, yes. I've been trying to turn my back to the soil for 10 years. Another child speaks. The farmers may be the backbone of the country, but who wants to be a backbone? Another child speaks. I care not who hoes the lettuce of my country, if I can eat the salad. They all speak. Life! Psychic research! Jazz! Mr. Icky, struggling with himself, speaks. I must be quaint. That's all there is. It's not life that counts. It's the quaintness you bring to it. All speak in return. We're going to slide down the Riviera. We've got tickets for Piccadilly Circus. Life! Jazz! Wait, let me read to you from the Bible. Let me open it at random. One always finds something that bears on the situation. He finds a Bible lying in one of the dods, and opening it at random, begins to read. Ahab and Istemo and Anim, Goson and Olon and Gilo, 11 cities and their villages, Arab and Rumah and Esau. Charles interrupts cruelly. Buy 10 more rings and try again. Mr. Icky does try again. How beautiful art thou, my love! How beautiful art thou! Thy eyes are dove's eyes, besides what is hid within. Thy hair is as flocks of goats which come up from Mount Gilead. Rather a coarse passage. His children all laugh at him rudely, shouting, Jazz! And all life is primarily suggestive. He responds despondently, It won't work today. Maybe it's damp. He feels the Bible. Yes, it's damp. There was water in the dod. It won't work. They all reply, It's damp. It won't work. Jazz. One of the children speaks. Come, we must catch the 6:30. Goodbye. They all go out. Mr. Icky is left alone. He sighs, and walking over to the cottage, steps, lies down, and closes his eyes. Twilight has come down, and the stage is flooded with such light as never was on land or sea. There is no sound except a sheepherder's wife in the distance playing an aria from Beethoven's 10th Symphony on a mouth organ. The great white and gray moths swoop down and light on the old man until he is completely covered by them. But he does not stir. The curtain goes up and down several times to denote the lapse of several minutes. A good comedy effect can be obtained by having Mr. Icky cling to the curtain and go up and down with it. Fireflies or fairies on wires can also be introduced at this point. Then Peter appears, a look of almost imbecilic sweetness on his face. In his hand he clutches something, and from time to time glances at it in a transport of ecstasy. After a struggle with himself, he lays it on the old man's body and then quietly withdraws. The moths chatter among themselves and then scurry away in sudden fright. And as night deepens, there still sparkles there, small, white, and round, breathing a subtle perfume to the West Isaacshire breeze, Peter's gift of love, a mothball. The play can end at this point, or can go on indefinitely. The end of Mr. Icky, the quintessence of quaintness in one act. As originally published in Tales from the Jazz Age by F. Scott Fitzgerald. Read by Rick Kistner for Lit2Go on the web at fcit.usf.edu.